Our reason for gathering today is to mark the 20th anniversary of the referendum vote in Wales, when 50.3% of the 1.1 million people who turned out and voted from the 2.2 registered voters voted yes, and 49.7% voted no. Just over 6,700 votes swung the outcome. We're here to reflect together on the journey of the last 20 years, the vote that led to the creation of the National Assembly for Wales, as well as on its changing powers, its remit, its membership, its legislative achievements, and to consider the governance challenges Wales faces in the coming years. First of all, we'll be looking back at what actually happened in the run-up to and on the night of the vote itself. Some of you, indeed many of you, were around at the time and played an active role in some shape or form. However, we're keen to make no assumptions that everyone in the room today knows every single one of the ins and outs of what happened. Many of our younger delegates will only have read about the campaign or heard about it from others. If we are going to reflect, it's worth setting things out from first principles. We'll be welcoming the First Minister, Calvin Jones, for a keynote shortly and hearing from prominent campaigners as well as from the media, with IWA fellow Hugh Edwards joining us and speaking on the importance of scrutiny and public policy in Wales as devolution has progressed. From an IWA perspective, while of course the government's issues themselves are important, what we also want to focus on are the concrete differences that having a National Assembly for Wales has made and is making to people's lives. What has been the dividend from devolution for the people of Wales? Part of that picture is the public perspective of devolution over the years, and who better to set this out than Professor Roger Scully, Wales's favourite sophologist. I thought I'd be tripping over sophologists, but not. Next, we'll be bringing together campaigners who, in various ways, have all engaged with the Assembly on a particular issue at different times and have helped shape a distinctly Welsh approach to policy and lawmaking. We'll be teasing out some of these issues in our Citizen Voices session after the break. After lunch, the Fearith will be reflecting on the changing face of the Chamber before we move into a panel session that looks forward to future governance challenges for Wales. Unfortunately, Professor Richard Wynne-Jones is stuck in Oslo and unable to join us today, so Roger will kindly come back and pull together the themes and reflect on the whole day before we close. Inevitably, context is highly significant. Today's anniversary offers us the opportunity to look back coolly and calmly and remember the events leading up to the vote in which Wales said yes to the Assembly. Anniversaries are also important because they enable us to step away from our day-to-day pressures and reflect on what the past means for our future. Today's world, which even 18 months ago looked and felt fairly certain and reliable from a number of perspectives, globally, politically, economically, and socially, today's world is one characterised by uncertainty. In Wales, with new powers coming into force next April under the Wales Act 2017, which recognises the National Assembly for Wales and the Welsh Government as permanent among the UK's constitutional arrangements, we're in a very different place to 20 years ago. Overlay that with the prospect of Brexit ahead and the myriad questions posed by the highly contested EU withdrawal bill being debated at the moment in Westminster, and the current atmosphere of political and economic uncertainty looks set to continue for some time to come. We simply cannot tell what the relationships between the various parts of the UK will be like in a year's time. There is everything to play for, and yet, emphatically, this is not a game. This is serious. The implications of Brexit on Wales start with a potential exit from the single market, impacting on the 67% of our exports going to Europe, hitting us harder than any other region in the UK, in particular our agriculture, forestries and fishing. And they go on to foreshadow a net loss of the equivalent of almost 1% of our GDA and structural funds. The potential implications for higher education in Wales are also significant. Opportunities for Wales are theoretical and as yet untried and untested because the wider political landscape has been utterly changed since devolution. But before we get ahead of ourselves, I'd like to ask you to keep in mind throughout the day one of our key questions. What has been the devolution dividend for Wales over the last 20 years? Have people in Wales not only observed but experienced an improvement in their economy, public services, communities and well-being? We asked some of these same questions 3 years ago as part of our constitutional convention project. At the time, we concluded there was no overwhelming success story here for Wales, just as there wasn't an overwhelming sense of failure either. For many, devolution in Wales remains a work in progress. 3 years later, do we still need to call for a greater focus on performance and for more ambition, as we did then. Ambition. Let's pick up on that and go back to reflect on the context and events that led up to the Wales Said Yes vote on 18th of September in 1997. Let's look at the ambition of both campaigns. One of the promises of devolution was that of a new politics, different from Westminster, more inclusive, more representative of the people of Wales. Please welcome our panellists for the first session, BBC Cymru political reporter Bethan Lewis and Leighton Andrews, then co-founder of the Yes campaign and now visiting professor of practice in public service leadership and innovation at Cardiff Business School. Thank you. I'm sorry we haven't been joined by a member of the No campaign. We talked about this just before. We tried a number of people, but unfortunately we were unable to find anybody who's available to participate this morning. So we'll be counting on you and obviously delegates here to fill in some of the gaps as when we open up the floor to discussion. Bethan, can I start with you please and ask you to take us back and set the broader scene and remind us where we were in early 1997 in the run-up to May's general election and in the 6 months or so before the referendum here. What was going on politically? What was the mood among the parties?
Well, first of all, just to explain what I was doing in 97, I was a researcher at the time in the University of Glamorgan at that time, and then started as a researcher in Aberystwyth in August of 97, just before the referendum. So my perspective on it was really researching the 2 years from 1997, looking back at what happened in that period, and talking to the main people involved at the time, interviewing them, inviting up and analysing what they had to say. But if we go back to early 97, there'd been 18 years of Conservative government. Tony Blair was a very popular man at the time, and it was just before, obviously, the May election when Labour got a landslide victory. And as part of their election programme, they had proposals to have referenda for a Welsh Assembly and a Scottish Parliament. But the decision to have a referendum was quite late on, really. It was in, I think, about June of 96, a very controversial decision at the time to have a referendum. Before that, the assumption was that it would just be introduced as part of their programme. So there was no real obvious Yes campaign at the time. I think the Yes for Wales campaign had been set up maybe in December of 96. But in terms of sort of open discussion campaigning, I think it was really parked until after that election in May. And that was deliberate, really. Part of the reason to have the referendum was that the talk of the Constitution, especially the fact that there was a tax-raising element to the Scottish proposals, that wasn't discussed in the run-up to the election. That was parked until after the election and in the referendum.
Thanks. Leighton, can you set out the genesis then of the campaign and what stands out for you in terms of the driving forces within it?
Yes, we started discussing setting up the Cross-Party Yes for Wales campaign in June 96. I was actually still working for the BBC in London, head of public affairs at the time, but I knew I was leaving, so I was moving back to Wales, having just got married to Anne. And Peter Hayne and I discussed this. There was a desire from the Labour side to create a campaign that was cross-party, and it was seen as a potential vehicle for drawing the other parties together and drawing in people who have no party affiliation. So we went through a process of starting to put together names to join the campaign. As Bethan said, the first meeting was in, I think the first meeting was actually in December 96. We launched in February 97. The rationale was that we felt we wanted to get a message out that was clear of the general election campaign. And the parties in Wales, of course, which had different positions on devolution and the nature of an assembly, would inevitably be scrapping over their preferred version. The Labour pledge card had a specific pledge for Wales about the assembly. Obviously, the Liberal Democrats and Plaid Cymru had their own versions of what they wanted to see, and the Conservatives were at that then very much opposed to it. So we wanted to create a sense, and Kevin Morgan, who was the chair of the campaign in the back of the room now, kicked off the launch. We
developed a slogan that we used for several months. You know, devolution is too important to be left to the politicians. And our sense was we wanted to involve people from all walks of life. And we, before we launched the campaign itself, we actually launched a business forum for devolution, which the Western Mail headlined, "Tycoons Say Yes." There weren't that many tycoons. Quite a lot of people associated with the independent television production sector in Wales, but I don't think they were. One of them has now probably become a tycoon, actually, but anyway, at that stage. So the other thing I would say is that we have very little money. This was also a period in which there was no regulation of referenda. Indeed, the Neil Committee, on which established the framework subsequently put into law under the Political Parties, Elections and Referendums Act 2001, some of its recommendations were very much based on its observations of the Welsh campaign. I can remember Dr. David Butler sniffing slightly haughtily at the suggestion that there should be a better balance of funding, that there had been a reasonable balance in the Welsh referendum, which he clearly didn't believe. But the final thing I want to say about 97 is that 97 was absolutely overshadowed by memories of 1979 and the failed referendum in 1979. And there was a strong sense in... Labour had come a very long way in that period in Wales. Plaid Cymru was very clear it didn't want to be made a scapegoat for a failure of another referendum, and that was absolutely understandable from as far as I can see. You know, they felt they had, in 1979, carried the brunt of the campaign, as did the Liberals at the time. So there were quite a lot of suspicions to be got over, and I think Ron Davies played a very important part, in fact, in bringing together people like David Wigley, Yian Wynn, and Richard Livesey, and Alex Carlisle, who was involved at the time as well, in ensuring that there was a cross-party perspective on this and that people were able to feel comfortable ultimately with what came about.
Because at the time, I was listening to Ron Davies yesterday saying that a third of Labour MPs were in favour and a third against and a third were on the fence. Do you think that's a fair assessment? Because holding that must have been quite hard.
Well, it didn't come out like that in the referendum. I think we had four Labour MPs who were dissidents, in fact, in the campaign. I mean, one of the problems immediately after the May election was that the Labour government then went into, obviously, the process of publishing the white paper, putting the Referendum Act for Scotland and Wales through. And a lot of the younger and newer Labour MPs who had just been elected were less acquainted with parliamentary procedure than some of the more sceptical old stagers. I'm thinking of Denzil Davis and Ted Rowlands, particularly at the time, who, you know, used the passage of the referendum bill to raise quite critical questions about how the Assembly might work. So there was a backdrop, I would say, from that period of May through to the publication of the white paper at the end of July, which was quite a sceptical backdrop, a negative backdrop. There was the Conservatives particularly sought to whip up an alleged row between Ron Davies and Clare Smith in Blaenau Gwent as to whether Clare was allowed to voice his dissent. And that story ran for 4 to 6 weeks in that period and took some of the oxygen out of the campaign, actually. And it wasn't until we had the white paper at the end of July we actually had something to campaign on. So that was, you know, less than 2 months before the referendum.
Yeah, so a fairly quick period of time from that perspective. Bethan, there's been lots in the news the last few days about this anniversary, and I was again hearing about how the Just Say No campaign was essentially fairly shambolic, not particularly Conservative-led, in contrast to this Yes for Wales coalition. Perhaps this wasn't surprising, given their defeat at the general election, and the campaign was the bus going around the country run by two very nice women, Betty Bowen and Carys Pugh, and that the Tories had judged that post their defeat in May, and with no MPs and only 42 councillors across Wales, their chances of coming back into power would be significantly less if they had voted against the new mechanism for making that potentially possible. Do you think that's a fair characterisation of the campaign, or do you think it was underestimated?
might have been underestimated if you look at the eventual results, because they came very, very close to winning the referendum. But yes, I think it's true the Conservatives didn't really want to be front and centre of any no campaigning view of their position politically in Wales at the time. Our MPs, they supported a very low ebb, so you know they wanted to make it a cross-party. It wasn't never going to be cross-party, but not just exclusively Conservative campaign then. So they did join up with Carys Pugh and Betty Bowen, who were sort of two stalwarts of the Labour Party in the Rhondda, who I think got involved in the campaign by initially just writing a letter to the Western Mail, and then they got phone calls, it developed into some sort of campaign, and they were backed as well by Robert Hodge, a businessman who was the son of Sir Julian Hodge, who was a financier, a very rich man, set up the Bank of Wales. And apparently the sort of contact between those two groups, because they wouldn't necessarily have sort of mixed in the same circles, was George Thomas, Viscount Mackenzie. So he was instrumental in making those links. He was into the plan of devolution, and he sort of got Betty Bowen and Carys Pugh in touch with Robert Hodge. The Conservatives also got involved. But yes, it was, you know, if the Yes campaign was late in the day in terms of setting up, the No campaign was even later. I think it's probably about July, end of June, July when they started being active, and the bus was the sort of main feature of their campaign. They did a lot of leafleting, not much else really.
Because we were before, obviously, social media, Twitter, Facebook, everything, Instagram.
Can I just add on the road campaign? Because when I wrote this book, which is still available...
There's the plug, folks.
I did actually interview various members of the road campaign, Jonathan Evans, who had been a Conservative MP, subsequently MP, and then MP again, Nick Bourne and David Melding. And it was quite clear that although it appeared that the No campaign was Carys Pugh and Betty Bowen actually voted for me to be the Labour candidate in the Rhondda subsequently, as it happens, but there we are. The reality was that a lot of the organisation on the ground was being done by Conservative Party officials, including Conservative Party agent and others, who were putting in place on the ground in the areas where the Conservative Party still had strength, you know, a reasonably strong No campaign. And I think we underestimated that as the Yes campaign at the time. I think the other thing we didn't know until subsequently, once, you know, we'd been researching this book and Bethel was doing research for the one she was involved with, was that there was actually contact between some of the dissident Labour MPs and the No campaign, although they never revealed that in public. I also think we've got to say that they found a very articulate public spokesperson in Tim Williams, Dr. Tim Williams, who became their de facto chair and was highly present in the media. Dr. Williams, I'm pleased to say, is now a convert to devolution and worked indeed as my specialist advisor when I was the Deputy Minister for Regeneration. So, you know, it does prove that you always welcome converts.
But in Australia, though.
But he's now in Australia.
Unfortunately, couldn't be with us today either. Can we just go back to the differences between Scotland and Wales? Because obviously there'd been a constitutional convention in Scotland and a lot of conversation and discussion about that, but none of that groundwork had been done here. So in terms of how things actually... I mean, turnout was very low, wasn't it?
Yeah, and there hadn't been that public discussion in Wales. Obviously, back in 1979... there had been a yes vote in Scotland, but not enough. It didn't cross the threshold to actually set up the assembly. Was it at the time when the Parliament they proposed in 1979? The situation was so different, as Leighton said, the vote in Wales was overwhelmingly against. So there was a lot of nervousness about broaching the subject again, no great public appetite for it. And in Scotland, they had this constitutional convention involving civil society and, John Smith, the Labour leader at that time in the early 90s, said it was the settled will of the Scottish people, which it probably wasn't at that time in Wales. And it was very tightly controlled within the Labour Party as well. You know, there was a fear of the divisions that had appeared in 79, so it was all very tightly controlled within the Labour Party, and only got discussed in a more broader setting when the Labour Party were confident that they had, you know, the unity, or as much unity as possible in an issue.
I think it's also, I mean, I agree with everything that just said, but I think it's also worth saying Labour Party didn't really agree its position until, broadly speaking, halfway through 1995. And then, of course, there was a decision to have a referendum, which had not originally been part of the plan. And Ron Davies, I think, quite cleverly used the new opportunity, the referendum, to achieve some shift within the Labour Party in Wales on the subject of proportional representation, which became very important, obviously, to get endorsement from other pro-devolution parties in Wales. But that referendum, when it was announced in 95, I think, was it? 96.
96 is the consensus, apparently. Okay.
There was quite a lot of concern amongst pro-devolution people in Wales. As it happened, Kevin felt the same, that I felt that you had to have a referendum to reverse the memory of 1979, given the vote in 79 was 4-1 against. I felt we needed some democratic mandate, and I thought it could be won. I was living in London, so I was probably quite naive about the state of mind of the people in Wales at the time. But I do think, in retrospect, if we not had that referendum, I think it would have been a much more difficult year for the National Assembly. You needed some kind of popular endorsement.
Can we just go back to the, literally the run-up to the vote itself and the night? So we were talking, I know Roger's going to talk about later on today how there were two almost different realities at one point, weren't there, in Broadcasting House, with S4C saying yes and the BBC saying no. Have I got it the right way around? I think I have.
According to Vaughan.
Yeah, yeah. And what did it feel like on the night?
I was in the Park Hotel. Kevin and other colleagues were over in college where the results were being brought into the central place. But I think it was, we were overly optimistic going in, and there had been a BBC exit poll that evening as well, which had suggested the Yes campaign was going to win by 55-45%, which was a healthy sounding majority. Kevin didn't believe it, I remember him saying at the time. So we were trying to keep in touch, with what was happening, getting information in from the count. I'll read you a little section in a minute. And the information coming in was patchy. We had some early no results. I think Wrexham came in early, and I remember Ian Wynne was in the Park Hotel. He said to me, that's not too bad, the defeat we had there. Others, we had a string of no results. Then we got word that Bridgend had gone yes. I should read you a little extract. It shows how long-standing relationships were forged. Darren Hill and I in the Park Hotel were in touch by mobile phone with Mary James in the college. Mary had heard from Cadwyn Jones, a Labour councillor in Bridgend, who was the leader of the local Yes for Wales group, that they had won there. Cadwyn was one of our most reliable activists. Be careful what you write. I wrote that 18 years ago. We had a small folk band playing in the corner of the Park Hotel, only they were a bit dirge-like, so we had to stop them playing because everybody was getting more and more depressed. But eventually, we saw the gap starting to close a bit. And based on the interviews I did with Ron Davis, the special advisors, Nick Ainger, who was his DPS at the time, Andrew Davis, who was a Labour referendum organiser, It's clear now that they had a reasonably early indication of what the vote was in Carmarthen and the likely majority in Carmarthen. The problem was they didn't know what the vote was in Powys. And you think about it, we still have mobile phone problems in Powys. You can imagine what mobile phone problems were like in 1997. So it wasn't until they were clear about the Powys result, Richard Lipsey was trying to phone all his Liberal Democrat contacts in Powys to get that result, that it became clear that a victory was there.
Interesting. So going back and thinking about, I mean, the benefit of 20 years hindsight, 2020 vision, what do you think, Bethan, could have been done differently? Or if, what could have been done differently by the campaigns? A, to get more people out. There were suggestions that it was a bit elitist in terms of the conversation. It didn't really get lots of people coming out, did it? I mean, look at the vote for Brexit last year. We had 500,000 people, more people voting last year than 20 years ago for this referendum. How do you think they could have got a bigger turnout, for instance?
So it's easy to say that if there had been a sort of wide-ranging public discussion about devolution in Wales in a, you know, run-up to 97, probably more people would have turned out to vote. But it happened the way it did because of the politics, because of the shadow of 79. Who knows, maybe if there had been a wide-ranging public discussion,
it would have meant an over... You know, it wouldn't necessarily have benefited the yes side.
We get into odd territory about what would have happened if we hadn't had a National Assembly for... I'm not sure if we... Yeah, I hope we're going to have that conversation today.
But in terms of sort of lessons from the campaign, I don't know, what struck me from looking back at the material and talking to the people involved and reading now what they'd said. I spoke to Betty Bowen and Carys Pugh as well, sort of a year after the referendum result, and the sort of things they were saying reminded me a lot of what we'd heard during the referendum campaign, actually, the sort of real sort of concern about cost and bureaucracy, all that sort of stuff, but also real disengagement with politicians and a feeling that this sort of elitist project was being sort of imposed on them. A lot of cynicism about politics and politicians, and that sort of thread, I think, carried on really into...
Referendum,
yeah.
Do you think there's anything you would have done differently later in terms of the Yes campaign?
I don't think we had much option, really. I mean, I think there are a number of, you know, factors. We did for a brief period see the start of the emergence of the Welsh Mirror. This is Ryan Giggs Says Yes, for those of you who've forgotten, which was delivered for us by Alistair Campbell. I think there was a big problem about. From our perspective, there's a problem about the media. This will sound similar to the Brexit referendum. The Yes campaign had a lot of activity going on. The No campaign had very little activity going on. This is also true in 2011, let me say, in the 2011 referendum. But because of the rules of balance, despite the fact there was very little going on the ground from the No campaign, they got as much coverage as the Yes campaign. There is also that wider issue, I think, of the media deficit in Wales, which is that, you know, most people in Wales read newspapers written in London, and only The Mirror, really, and latterly The Financial Times, which a lot widely read in Wales, gave much coverage to the campaign. You know, BBC Wales, ITV in Wales did their best, but there were still quite large sections of Wales that were not tuned into, you know, Welsh media, particularly in North East Wales, for example. So all of those things, I think, had a factor. But I think I do agree with Bethan that the ground had not been prepared in Wales in the way that it had been prepared in Scotland through the Scottish Constitutional Convention. You know, we were probably, I'm certain that we were naive. You know, if I contrast the campaign that we ran in 2011, where we had a significant result in Wales in favour of the new settlement, compared to 97, it was a shoestring campaign. I've called it before the last analogue campaign. You know, we had very little money, we had to do things in a rush. The parties, you know, the Labour Party put in a substantial chunk of money, like Cymru did, in their key seats. But I think that there was overwhelmingly a degree of naivety about how embedded that pro-devolution feeling was within Wales. And I do think, you know, and people, you said at the beginning, Oriel, that Tony Blair was very popular at the time. Tony Blair's intervention was actually very important. You know, he came to Wales a number of times. There was quite a strong sense, I think, in the valleys that, well, we're not quite sure what this is, but the boss says he's in favour of it, so we'll go with it. And I do think that was important. It was borne out in what the focus groups told us, Philip Gould's focus groups told us in the run-up. So I think
that sometimes gets underestimated because people look back at, you know, the Blair era now through a different lens. But it was important. It was very important that referendum came in the first 6 months of that government, rather than in the dog days of a parliament as it had done in 1979.
Yeah. And Bethan, after the vote, it's been said that the No campaigners, you know, the voted. Came down obviously on the yes side. They just rolled up their sleeves and they got on with helping shape the National Assembly. Do you think and played an important role in that crafting of devolution when the decision had been made? What sort of contribution do you think they made?
Well, someone like Nick Bourne obviously played a significant role and continues to play a significant role. You know, the sense that you got from people like Betty Bowen and Carys Pugh weren't involved that directly in the early days, and they sort of went back to their lives, and I'm not sure whether they were still supporting the Labour Party. Betty Bowen was still active, was she? I'm not sure about Carys Pugh afterwards. But their feeling was, now we voted for it, we've got to make it work, and that was the general sense that you got from the interviews with people in the couple of years after the referendum.
And going back to what Leighton just said about, you know, people in the valleys saying the boss had said it's a good idea, let's go for it, this may be one of the places where there is, you know, some sort of parallel with last year's referendum. People voting for change but not knowing what that change is going to be and what it's going to mean for them.
Yeah, well, I do see some parallels in the sort of trends and the feelings that were sort of voiced by the No campaigners compared to the same sort of things as the Leave campaigners this time. But obviously, it went a different way. The government got obviously won the referendum in 1997, and David Cameron lost it, as we know, in the Brexit referendum. One thing, just going back to what you were saying about the last week and last week's focus on Tony Blair and his popularity. I was rereading an interview we'd done with the Director of Communications for the Labour Party centrally at the time, and a feeling that they'd taken Wales for granted. Mm-hmm. And he was saying that the big message in the last couple of weeks was vote Blair, vote yes, you know. But he said that the focus had been so much on Scotland that Wales had been taken for granted. And specifically on the second question in the Scottish referendum, because obviously in Scotland you had two questions. You had yes or no to the Parliament and yes or no to tax raising powers, and they were a lot less certain about that second element, about the tax raising powers, and they felt that they had focused most of their energies on that and hadn't really taken much notice of what was going on in Wales.
I think the Welsh Office team at the time, and in the interviews I did with them afterwards, said that they had argued very strongly with Milbank that Scotland should be seen as a safe seat and Wales is the marginal seat, if you like, in terms of the campaign planning. And I think they did get a fair spread of money from the Labour Party centrally for the Welsh campaign. But there was always that sense of, you know, well, it is settled in Scotland. The issue was that second question. But it became, I think, we haven't even talked about Diana. Actually, you know, that was quite a significant moment. Let me say, you know, two and a half weeks out from the Welsh referendum, 10 days out from the Scottish referendum, you have that tragic death in Paris, which the campaign goes on hold for several days as a result of that. There is a sense, Rodri expressed it, Rodri Morgan expressed it in an interview I did with him in the book, that, you know, you got a resurgence of Britishness in quite a big way in that period immediately afterwards, and some people feel that blunted the nature of the message as well. Certainly we lost some time of campaigning and we lost some explanatory time, you know, as a result of that. So I think there were difficulties like that people even now probably need to reflect on, because it was a very strange period, that those few days. In the end, you know, David Hill, the Labour Director of Communications and others, came to Wales and spent a lot of time, you know, supporting the campaign here. And I think there was an understanding that, you know, Labour could not afford for this to be lost. And there was clear leadership from Labour in the 1997 referendum. You asked about parallels with the Brexit referendum. I'm not clear there was clear leadership from Labour in the Brexit referendum.
Okay, thank you, both of you. Can I just have a show of hands, please, as to who was actively involved in campaigning at the time, 20 years ago? There are more than that, come on. Don't be shy. I can see three. Good, I thought the room might be a bit fuller of people who've been involved. We're going to open up to Q&A, please, now from the audience. Who would like to go first? We've got a roving mic at the back. Okay, here we go. Cathy. Shay, can we have a mic down to Cathy just here? Cathy, I'm going to give you mine.
Check. Hello, one, two, there.
Thanks very much for that. Leighton, I have a question for you. Given that the rules for how you win a referendum didn't come in until a couple of years later, what did you get away with that you wouldn't have got away with now?
Well, the honest answer is I don't think we got away with anything because we didn't have any money. We had a small grant from the Roundtree Trust. We had a £10,000 donation from Unison. The campaign office was based in my company office in Cardiff, so it was, rent free. Those things would have had to be declared, obviously. The issue when the Neil Committee was taking evidence was that they took the Welsh office investment in information about what the Assembly was going to do as though it was money for the Yes side. That was the David Butler's view of it when the Neil Committee left. I remember, giving evidence to it. There's an interesting point here, which is, I do touch on the book, Peter Mandelson did a very important job within Whitehall in getting explicit agreement as to what was appropriate for governments to say in respect of the information that they were giving to their publics. Scotland was behaving in one way, quite a generous way in terms of the information that it was going to give out, the timing of its drop, its mail drop about its white paper and so on. But civil servants in the Welsh office, as it was then, were actually being very restrictive and constraining as to the advice they were giving ministers as what they could do. So Mandelson convened a special cabinet committee to discuss these issues. And it was made, it's made clear what Scotland was doing. Peter Hayne said in that committee, well, that's not the advice I'm getting. And subsequently, the advice was adjusted. But no, I don't think we got away with anything we wouldn't have got away with in 2011, Gavin.
Thank you. There was a question over here.
Claire. Claire Hudson. I was involved in making a documentary for HTV Wales following the campaign in 97. And I think one of the things that struck me, and it'd be interesting to get Leighton's view on this, is that you needed to have a story about what had happened to Wales. And I think possibly you've downplayed the role that Ron Davies played in that, because he had a story that I think chimed with certainly a lot of the people we talked to, which was, not interested in devolution in 79, but look what has happened to Wales in that, generation since. And he, he told that great story about seeing that graffiti that said, Wales voted Labour, we got Thatcher. And it being a kind of moment on the road to Damascus, if you like. And I think he really powerfully embodied, in many ways not a very charismatic politician until then, but he embodied that story that you could tell in the campaign about what had happened to Wales since the last vote. And I think, certainly I felt on the ground that was very powerful symbolically with the electorate.
Yes, I mean, I think that's absolutely fair. Ron himself dated the period of change in Welsh Labour to that period after Thatcher's third victory in 87. And he makes that point, the story he he told quite widely, I think, at that time. And I think that's right. I think that did gel, but I'm not clear that it was quite enough, as it happens. I mean, I think it was part of the narrative that was being framed. But then you have to go on and say, and what difference would an assembly make? So, you know, the message, I can't remember, Kevin, or it was you or someone came out with, which was, don't let Wales get left behind, you know, which we came up with as a campaign, and then Peter and others started to use as ministers. That was kind of trying to take that argument on to the next stage. Well, Wales has been through this. Scotland's going to get a parliament, you know, don't let Wales get left behind. That was part of that very strong message. But I certainly agree with you that Ron had managed to create that narrative very strongly. I think one of the difficulties, though, for that Welsh Office team was that they were, in those first couple of months after May, they were bedded down in having to deliver the Referendum Act and get the white paper written. So there was, you know, there wasn't a lot of campaigning going on in that period until that white paper was published. And they were actually restricted under government rules. And unless you've passed a legislation, you know, setting out what the Assembly is going to do, you can't, you know, there's a limit to how much you can campaign on it, even though they had a white paper. So I think they were restricted to a bit. And as I say, I think the campaign eventually kicked off, but quite late.
John Davis is obviously, you know, very passionately committed to the cause. When you were talking earlier about a strong advocate as opposed to the situation with Brexit, were you talking about Ron or
at
the time? Because
he
was a bit more ambivalent, though, about devolution.
He was, but publicly he came and campaigned in Wales. Publicly, Tony Blair came and campaigned in Wales on a number of occasions. But yes, but I mean, Ron had carried that all the way through. He'd carried it through the Labour Party. He'd ensured that he'd kept close to Plaid Cymru leaders and to Richard Livesey. So, you know, he had built that, and he had a very clear view himself of what needed to be done, and he was very actively campaigning. But Tony Blair, of course, appointed Peter Haynes specifically into the Welsh Office to drive the referendum campaign. That was what he was there for.
But there's very strong personal relationships between Richard Livesey and Ron Davis, yeah. And his ability to sort of work with other politicians, that was crucial as well, wasn't it? And summed up by that photo, you know, that famous scene at the Royal College of Music and Drama on the following morning.
Indeed.
Right. Any other questions? There's one in the middle over there, please. Thank you.
Hello, John Lloyd from the Financial Times. You talked a bit about how Scotland had a convention and prepared much more for devolution. In reflecting on this, have you thought that perhaps it was a deeper reason as well? And that was that Scotland had a state, a fully fledged state, modern in a sense at the time, and Wales had not. And that you can't go back in history and create a state where none existed, but that history does have an effect on the present, and still does have an effect on the present. Even unionists in Scotland had to defer to the view that a state had been lost, and therefore some other mechanism had to come into play. Was that a hindrance to you? Is it still a hindrance to you?
I think that's an interesting question, John. You can't compare the histories of Wales and Scotland and their relationship to the British state. Clearly, they are very, very different. Well, you can compare them, but they are very, very different. To my mind, it was more the kind of, it was more recent history, actually, that mattered than longer-term history. So recent history in the sense of what I said at the beginning, the shadow of 1979 and the need to overcome that, and then immediately more recent history, those things that during the 1980s had provoked a stronger sense of Welsh identity, such as the miners' strike, you know, the campaign to get S4C as a Welsh language channel. I take those as symbolic, evidence, if you like. And I think those things were there motivating people who were involved in that campaign. But yes, you know, you couldn't have a symbolic appeal to bring back Wales's parliament, because we'd have had to go back to Owen Glyndŵr to do that. And that was only a temporary thing in a small place. And somebody once described it as, I can't remember what they described it as, but it was not exactly representative of the whole of Wales, shall we say.
Thank you. Yes.
Thank you. Peter Evans, Transition Chepstow. A term which has reached prominence in the recent referendum is, of course, fake news. Is there anything that you may recall from the No or Yes campaign that would be referred to the statistician Royal?
Bethan, would you like to take this one?
Oh, I can't remember the exact figures that were being bandied about. But, well, actually, I was looking back at some Just Say No campaign literature, and there was something about the Assembly costing 100 and something million over the course of a parliament, and the equivalent that would, you know, in nurses and teachers or whatever. I don't think any of the figures were checked out particularly closely on either side. At the time, it was a very short, dense campaign. I can't remember any sort of real scrutiny of the figures. It was all, you know, a lot more to do with the slogans, the sort of broad messages, rather than scrutiny of figures in that sense. And there was a lot of sort of, you pointed out, the Ryan gigs, Ryan, a lot of sort of celebrity endorsements, that sort of thing. Gary Speed, on the other hand, was a no supporter at the time, so it sort of balanced out. But yes, I definitely had more of that. But I don't know if there was any obvious examples of.
I think the No campaign was actually very effective in its targeting of messages. It picked the things that it thought would undermine, you know, people's sympathy for the Assembly. So the salaries of Assembly members, there was a written question to Ron Davis, which asked, you know, what was the estimated cost of the Assembly over, you know, a certain number of years. And also what were the salaries likely to be, and so on and so forth. So they picked out those figures. I wouldn't, you know, I think one has to be very careful with the term fake news, but they, you know, they, in their propaganda, they were, I think, targeted and quite and very effective, actually. Mm.
Okay, Geraint.
I was at the BBC at the time, and I'd, very struck in the middle of the campaign, Leighton mentioned the death of Diana and the impact of that. And I just wanted to relate that to the question of the dates of the two referenda in Scotland and in Wales. I mean, I remember in that particular week, we had the death of Diana and the death of Mother Teresa and the death of conductor George Shalty. There were some people in the BBC who were praying that the Queen Mother could hang on till the next financial year. But in a way, the recovery time after the death of Diana was relatively short in Scotland, because Scotland was a week ahead of Wales. We had an extra week to recover. It might not have made it, might have lowered the majority in Scotland. And I just wonder whether that business of going a week after Scotland might have been really crucial to scraping through.
Well, I think it made a difference, because it accelerated the importance of that message, don't let Wales get left behind, in that last week. And I think the original proposal for the referenda to be held on different dates came from the Institute of Welsh Affairs, in fact, back in the day. So, you know, you can claim a part in this history quite in a number of ways.
All sorts of bits of history, yes.
Yes, here we are.
Yes.
I think people can hear me.
There's a mic just there.
No, we can't. No, they can't. No, they can't. All right.
It's on.
On, right. And David Caddock, I'm a veteran of Cardiff Says Yes in both 79 and 97. I was under Di Francis, good-hearted old communist, and then, of course, in Kevin Brennan in 97. And the thing that struck me was that the two no campaigns, the slippery slope, a llethr llithrig, we seem to hear far less about that in 97 than we did in 79, and also the bugan, the threat of the language, seemed to be much less played up by the no people. Would you agree with that?
I was in Bangor in 79, so, you know, my memories are through the prism of being there, student there. And I remember both those messages. I think there was still a use of quite divisive language by the No campaign. You know, one of their arguments, as I recall it, was that, you know, this National Assembly would set North against South, it would set East against West, it would set Welsh speaker against English speaker. I still think it was there. Yeah, I wouldn't like to try and make a judgment as to whether it was as strong as in 79. The slippery slope argument had been quite a well-trammelled conservative argument, it seems to me, throughout that period running up to the 97 general election. You know, John Major had essentially made speeches around that sort of theme. Even right up until, I think, in the Welsh Conservative Conference just before the general election. So it was still there, the backdrop. I'm not sure whether it was used as much since 79.
Catherine, what do you think?
I think that the threat of it leading to the breakup of the UK was a theme, and that was something that concerned the No campaigners. But in the context of Scotland as well, it wasn't just, you know, Welsh devolution, but Scottish devolution, so the wider picture. What was the other point about?
Slippery slope.
North versus South. I think that came out very clearly as well, actually. And talking to Stuart Andrew, who was one of the other No campaigners. Mm. I'm not sure, is he still a Conservative MP? He was a Conservative MP in England somewhere. He was from North Wales, and that was one of the concerns voiced by the No campaign as well, that the North would lose out to the South. So I think those two things did appear in 97 as well.
We'll be picking up on some of these throughout the day. For now, thanks very much indeed, both to Leighton and to Bethan, and we're moving on, Roger Scully, next. Thank you.